You're listening to Bits of Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. I'm Linnea Dunn, and I'm your host. In this episode of Bits of Me, I talk to Sarah Rose McCann, a freelance writer from Belfast who has been suffering from bladder problems and chronic pain since she was a child. She ended up developing anorexia as a way to distract herself from the pain, and it was only last year that she finally got her diagnosis of and treatment for endometriosis. What's it like being 8 years old and realising that you're starting to have these symptoms? So you had bladder pain, was it?
Yeah, so it was when I was eight when the bladder pain started. It was terrifying, really. I did not know what was wrong with me. I just remember being really, really scared and really confused. It was on a Saturday night when it first kicked in. I remember it really, really sticks out in my mind because I played trad. So I was just back from trad practice. So I did the fiddle, and the next day, me and a few girls from the trad group were going to the zoo, which was like a big thing. It was a massive thing when you're a child. And I went home and I went to the bathroom, and then after I peed, I felt like I needed to pee again, and I was really confused, and I was like, what's going on? So that was kind of when it first started, and for that whole night, it was just me sitting there on the toilet, like not being able to come off the toilet. It was just the feeling was the pressure, and there was something pushing, and it was just really, really scary. I remember I was really upset and I was crying, and I spent the whole night just sitting in the toilet, and my mum and dad were like, what's going on? Like, what's wrong with her? They thought it was probably an infection or a UTI or something like that.
Yeah.
But I just, that was kind of like my, my standout memory is me just sitting in the loo, like with a towel wrapped around me, being like, what's wrong with me? Like, what's happening? I want to go to the zoo tomorrow.
And what happened after that? Did the symptoms come and go, or what was it like?
No, that was really it. That was them. Just stayed with me. So we went to the doctors, and they just did all the urine samples and urine testing, and it was kind of like, well, there's no infection, so she probably just has a chill. Like, put her in tights, make sure she wears a thermal. Like, it's probably just something like that. But it didn't go away. It was just always feeling like I needed to urinate, never being able to empty my bladder. Just kind of, it was felt like it was cystitis, but obviously without infection. And it was just this fear that I built up around going to the bathroom because it was such a horrible, unpleasant experience. So absolutely everything revolved around, how do I get to the bathroom? How do I make the bathroom not hurt? How can I stand, like, put off going to the bathroom as long as possible?
Yeah.
So I would, you know, go as soon as I woke up, and then I would, my whole aim would be not to go during school, because if I went during school, it would be far too painful.
Yeah.
And then it was just always trying to manage it in a way that a child tried to understand it, because I didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah.
My parents didn't really know what was going on.
And that went on for how long?
That went on, well, what happened was it went on until I was 12. The symptoms were still there, but when I was 12, I developed an eating disorder, anorexia, to try to manage and distract myself from the pain. I was going into big school, and I just needed, for me, it was like the logical way, if I had something to always distract my, it kind of cropped up quite early. It wasn't like, oh, I want to go, you know, have an eating disorder. It was, I need something to try to distract myself. I need something to keep my mind occupied at all times.
Yeah.
So that I'm not thinking about pain. And it was kind of the most dangerously effective way at that time.
Yeah.
That I could always keep my mind thinking about something else. So it was always like, oh, you know, it was always thinking about food. It was always thinking about what I looked like, my weight. So that was kind of like the ultimate distraction. So between the ages of 12 to 18, I battled anorexia, and my symptoms did subside, in that I was constantly distracted and never thinking about going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
I had a few times where they would rear their head, but I was always so focused on my other illness that I kind of had like put a pin in that one. And then when I recovered from anorexia at age 18, all of a sudden these symptoms that I'd experienced as a kid came back. And then they stuck with me ever since.
And what was what did you think? So you were 18 and you had overcome this other huge battle, and then the symptoms came back. What went through your mind then? I mean, did you know what was going on, or what did you think?
No, I think I just remember thinking like, oh God, like, because as soon as the symptoms came back, it was kind of like that, a flashback memory and that feeling in the pit of your stomach, like, oh my goodness, like, is this what happened when I was a kid? Is this back? Like, this can't be back. I can't go through that again. And then it was like, what is wrong with me again? And then it was kind of the same old thing, you know, because I went to the doctor and the doctor said, oh, it's probably just a UTI. I had a boyfriend at the time, so they're like, oh, you're sexually active, you know, this is what happens with sexually active people. You might just have chlamydia, we'll do all the swabs, it's probably just an STD, or it's not an STD, it's probably just, you know, it was just, again, the same issue with no one really knew what was wrong. And there just didn't really seem to be anything, you know. I just didn't really know what was wrong, and I didn't really know what to do to help myself.
Yeah. And it was later on when you were living in England that you ended up getting some language for what was going on and some help.
Yes. So basically, between the ages of 18 to 24, I was kind of just dealing with this by myself. Like, I went to my GP. I was referred to urology for cystoscopy in Belfast, and I went through that. The cystoscopy was clear, so like, there's nothing wrong with you, you're discharged. The consultant was quite abrasive and was like, oh, it's probably your fault because you're sexually active, you know, and you just stop having so much sex, and maybe that'll stop you being in pain. And it was kind of frustrating because one of my main symptoms is painful sex, so I was like, well, I can't have sex. It was like, well, I'm not a gynecologist, so and it was just kind of that attitude of like, you know, you've done something to cause this. This has nothing to do with you. You know, you're young. There shouldn't be anything wrong with you. Like, please leave me be. That was kind of the attitude I was always getting. So I was put on a low dose antibiotic for 4 years because the theory was that, you know, it's probably an infection. We can't detect an infection, but we'll just give you antibiotics anyway, just in case it is an infection. So that was kind of what I was doing in my early 20s. And I wasn't really getting, you know, there was no relief at all. And then when I moved to England, it was kind of similar in that the same attitudes were there, and it was still kind of, oh, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, we can't see anything wrong with you. I went and had a second cystoscopy. And again, they were like, oh, we don't really know what is wrong with you. So it was kind of like this whole circle that was repeating itself. But thankfully, I was studying in Bath, and I joined like an online forum for women with bladder pain, and they said, oh, well, there's actually this condition called interstitial cystitis, like, have you ever heard of it? Has it ever been mentioned to you? And I was like, no, like, I had mentioned it previously when I lived in Northern Ireland, because I had heard of it and I suspected it, and it had been, you know, unanimously like ruled out. It was like, no, there's no way you could possibly have that, like, you're too young, you definitely couldn't have that. And then thankfully I was able to go to see a consultant in London, and I got my diagnosis there, which was kind of like the first step in really kind of having some peace of mind and some clarity for one aspect of the pain. But unfortunately, throughout the years, from the ages of 18 to 24, I started to develop not just bladder pain, but also quite significant bowel pain. And then I was also having a lot of pain during sex, painful orgasms, lower back pain, like extreme fatigue. Like, it was all these extra symptoms that were just kind of being, you know, it was like, okay, I kind of know what's wrong with my bladder now, but why do I have all these other things? Like, is it connected? Is it not connected? So although it was like one really great piece of mind, it was still like just one piece of the puzzle that needed to be filled in.
And I mean, you must have just been really sick and tired having dealt with all this and not had proper help or diagnosis for so long, and then more and more symptoms cropping up.
Yeah, and I think definitely when especially the bowel symptoms came, it was always put down to being IBS, and it was always like, oh, just take Buscopan, just do this. But it was like really impacting on my day, in that, you know, I would have my bladder pain where I'd be going to the bathroom, you know, like 10, 20 times a day, and 10, 20 times a night. Oh yeah, like, so especially when I was doing my degree, it was really bad, because with the constant pressure, and this is the same as a child, so with the constant pressure on your bladder, you always feel like you need to urinate. So when you fall asleep, your body's always waking you up to tell you to go pee. So you would never get a full night's sleep. It would always be a couple of hours and waking you up, a couple of hours and waking you up. But it was just kind of like torture, because you're trying to concentrate. And like, you had, oh God, I've got my dissertation to do. I like had sleep. Like, and, you know, having that as well. And then all of a sudden having these bowel issues, which kind of crept up from the age of 22 onwards. And they kind of weren't, it was kind of like, just take IBS, probably stress, probably anxious, have Buscopan. And that was kind of that. And there wasn't really, didn't seem to be anywhere to go for that aspect of the pain. And then regarding, I think, the painful sex aspect, I was always quite, I asked about it when I was 18, 19, and I did explore it, and I asked, and I told my GP, I'm having painful sex, and it was kind of like, oh, that's normal, these things happen.
Oh wow.
And that was kind of like the attitude, you know, like when I tried to explore that sort of pain, it was kind of like, oh, that's just one of those things, you know.
I know that you've said that you realized only last year, from Instagram, I think it was, that you were kind of recognizing the symptoms of endometriosis and going, whoa.
I had asked about endometriosis in the past, and I'd always been told, no, like, your pain's bladder bile. It's like a reproductive menstrual disease. It's nothing to do with bladder bile, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'd also had MRIs, and I'd been told that endometriosis can't be, you know, if it's clear MRI, you can't have endo. And which is incorrect, which I didn't know. So I set up, like, last year, I was just really fed up, because when I moved back to Belfast, I had my interstitial cystitis diagnosis. I also got diagnosed with a condition called pelvic floor dysfunction.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really getting anywhere. Like, it was just, all you can do is pelvic floor physio. So I was trying pelvic floor physio, but we weren't getting anywhere. It was like, we'd been doing the physio for so long. We were making some improvements, but my physio said, I think there might be something else going on here.
Yeah.
So I started Instagram to just be like, these are my symptoms. Does anyone know, like, what the hell's going on with me? And like, instantly everyone was like, you realize you have all the symptoms of endo. And I was like, I'm what? What? I was like, no, I don't. No. Like, if I had endo, I would know. Like, I know. And then I was like, someone would have said by now. Someone would have joined the dots. And then they're like, no, like, have a look. And then I looked up the symptoms, and it was just like a gut punch. It was just like, oh my, like, this is it. Like, these are all the symptoms I have. This is everything that I've been going through. The bowel pain, the bladder pain, you know, the sexual pain. And also, I have always had painful periods, but again, it's always been normalized. It's always been just being one of them things. So I'd never even considered painful periods as an issue. Like, I thought that was standard.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So it was through, a bunch of strangers on Instagram that I realized that actually this might be what's going on with me as well, as those other issues.
So you were diagnosed by Instagram before you were diagnosed by a professional. Wow.
I was, to be honest, like, I didn't really feel like it was real when all the symptoms came, and they kind of correlated. I think even after I had my surgery, and my surgeon said, you know, I suspected it, because my surgeon was like, well, wait until we get the histology report, which is the pathology report of the tissue. He was like, well, wait, then that'll officially confirm you have endo. So I was really scared. I didn't want to be like, I have endo, until I officially had that certificate.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it. It was like, I must, you know, it was kind of like I was gaslighting myself, and it was like,
yeah,
you know, all these people, they mean well, but is that really what's wrong with me? Like, have I been in this much pain? Like, am I really, you know, worthy, not worthy, but, you know, have I actually, because, you know, see people with endo and they suffer so much on a regular basis, and it's like, am I am I like that? Yeah. Do I deserve, you know, like, or is it still just something that's in my head? And I think even after you get your diagnosis, that's something you kind of struggle with, because it's something that you've kind of lived with for so long, trying to always question, like, is this real?
Yeah.
Is this being really happening?
Because I suppose you've been almost made to feel as if it's in your head, because nobody could really pinpoint what it was.
I think so, definitely, yeah. And also because it was often downplayed and so often normalised, and especially, like, at times kind of made to see it feel a little insignificant, like, oh, it's only bladder pain, and, you know. And it's kind of like a lot of the time when you would try and talk about it, or when you would try and seek help about it, it wouldn't be taken as seriously as it was. And unfortunately, even after I got my endometriosis diagnosis, like, endo isn't taken as seriously as it is either. So I think that it's just these, having all these conditions together is kind of like a mixture of, you know, it's a bad batch, because, you know, a lot of doctors don't really believe or understand the pain that the patients are going through, and then they don't really have empathy in some ways, which, you know, can be really detrimental to your mental health when you're really struggling and all you want is someone to acknowledge or to try to help or to try to guide.
So it
can be really overwhelming.
So you got your diagnosis and surgery last year, but you had to go to England for that.
So I went to England, as well as a lot of other Irish women. So basically, when I started researching endometriosis, I discovered there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of misinformation just across the board. I got in touch with Endo Ireland, who are an amazing, amazing charity. Like, they are one of the best endo charities in the world, I would say, not being biased, but I think they're just fantastic. They're entirely volunteer ran, and it's a real, real push for factual knowledge, which is what patients need, it's what people need. Like, you just need to know the facts. So I decided that I wanted to go down the route of having a diagnostic laparoscopy with excision surgery. So excision surgery is a removal method that it cuts the endometriosis out, as opposed to ablation, which burns. So I just decided to go down the excision route option, because it's just the more gold standard option. However, accessing it is really hard because it is the gold standard option. And it can be quite hard to access. I couldn't find anywhere that I could access it in Northern Ireland. I couldn't find anywhere that I could access it in the Republic of Ireland. I chatted with a lot of women from Northern Ireland and from the Republic who went across to England to have this operation. And I decided that really, you know, that was the right route for me. I'd been suffering for so long. I was really privileged in that I was able to go down that route. If you're from the Republic of Ireland, I think you can claim back some of the costs from HSE. So there's quite a lot of women I chat with in Dublin and one's actually going over quite soon to go have her excision surgery. So there can be some insurance schemes, whereas if you're from the north, you have to front the cost yourself.
Oh, really? So it's not covered by the NHS?
Yeah. No, because we're not. In Northern Ireland, it's really, really frustrating. So basically, because of the devolved government, so we can't see someone in England because we're Northern Ireland. So if you want to see a specialist in the NHS in England, you need to get an NHS direct trust referral, but the process to go through that is quite lengthy, and then you have to prove, you know, the reason why you want to go across for that surgery. I wouldn't qualify because it wouldn't qualify to go across for excision surgery.
So you're relying then on the specialists that are available in Northern Ireland, and obviously that's very limited. So if you want to go to see somebody else, you have to fund it yourself.
Yeah, so it's the same. It depends. There's certain schemes they have, I think. But for things like endometriosis, if you want to go across to England and you're from Northern Ireland, even if you're in Scotland and you want to access excision surgery, if you can't access it in Scotland, you have to pay to access it in England.
Okay, yeah.
because it's different, it's like different states, if that makes, makes sense.
I'm just kind of like, well, so, the NHS covers all of it, so surely, but yeah, it's not that simple.
Yeah, I know. I thought the same, but no, so we financed the money, we took a credit, and then I was getting married, so we took the wedding money, and then we went across, and I had my surgery. It was terrifying, but it was really, really good in that I had my surgery, I had my diagnostic lap, and I had the excision. And endometriosis was found in my bladder, so I have bladder endo, which makes a lot of sense. So thankfully, my endo is, it's bladder based, and it was all excised. I also have it in my pelvic sidewalls, my punch of Douglas, all those lovely areas. I don't know where that those areas are. I'm not very good at the anatomy, but yeah, it was all excised. Everything was effectively removed, which was a really, really great first step. But I think a lot of people, when they think, oh, it's, you know, you've got your diagnosis, you've had your surgery, you're fine now, and that couldn't be farther from the truth, because endometriosis, it's a long-term chronic illness. It's the whole body disease. It impacts all aspects of your body. You know, even after excision surgery, you know, you have had the surgery, but you still have endometriosis. It doesn't just matter, like, the condition is still there in your body, even though all the endometriosis has been effectively removed. So like, I still do struggle with fatigue, I still do struggle with some cyclical pain around my period and my ovulation and stuff, but I do finally have immense relief from my bladder, and I can sleep throughout the night for the first time, which is amazing. So
yeah,
it's been a real wonderful experience, in that, you know, it's just this one little thing in this one little community that on Instagram, that if I hadn't have met them, I wouldn't have went on this journey, I wouldn't have been able to access this surgery, because I wouldn't have known about excision surgery. You know, there's not a lot of information out there about it. It's kind of usually from the charity organizations or from endometriosis support groups that you learn about it. So it was just, so I think I was just so lucky. Like, I don't think that, you know, I genuinely think that if it hadn't been for Instagram, who knows when I would have found out, you know?
Isn't it mad though? I mean, like, that, number one, that you didn't get a diagnosis and didn't realize exactly what was going on until these strangers on Instagram told you. And as you say, number two, that if it wasn't for them, you mightn't have found the support and then subsequently the care that you needed.
Definitely. And I think that I'm not alone in this experience. When I use my Instagram quite a lot now, I chat with a lot of people, and, you know, I get a lot of messages from people kind of in the same position that I was in prior to that, saying, you know, I just discovered these symptoms. What you're saying is what I have. Like, and then it's kind of like just, it's revolving. It's like a revolving door of people coming in and having these experiences and going out and getting their diagnosis. And it kind of seems like social media is kind of the place where people who are in pain or people who have conditions that aren't in the mainstream, or even though endometriosis is incredibly common, so it should be in the mainstream, but, you know, conditions that people aren't talking about or maybe aren't aware of, have somewhere to go and kind of ask the questions without feeling like they're intimidating anyone or kind of being knocked back or kind of being questioned. And it's kind of just like an open space where you can explore these things without fear, which I think is really, really important when, you know, when you go to see your GP, you only have like a 10-minute allocated slot to get in and out, so, you know, you can't ask all these questions. And I think that another thing that's quite good on social media as well is that, like, something I find really interesting is that, you know, you have like pelvic floor physiotherapists who have Instagram. You also have, like, for endo, there's a center of endo care, which is over Atlantis, one of the top endometriosis centers in the world. They have an Instagram and you can reach out to them, you know, and they're there. It's not like we're not like in a little island anymore. We can literally find all this information out and it's there. And that it's just so kind of empowering, because I think when we think about endometriosis, you know, it is something that people don't talk about. You know, it's a condition that, you know, I never heard of until really very much. And then having this space and this place where you can talk and where there is an opportunity for a voice is giving so much power to people who, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago didn't have an opportunity to talk about it, because where would they have talked about it?
Yeah.
So it does feel really empowering and uplifting. Mm.
And I mean, you've really made the most of that in that you have an Instagram account now where you share a lot about your own experience, what you're going through on a day-to-day yeah. basis. And you're being very, very generous and open with yourself. What made you decide to do that?
I think it kind of just came from when I first started. I was just so fed up. So for all these years that I had this pain, I never really told anyone. Like, it was just my partner, my parents, the odd friend. I never really was open about it. Because I felt a lot of shame about it, because it was kind of an embarrassing thing, talking about toilet stuff, and, you know, it was just kind of embarrassing. And then as well, I didn't know what was wrong with me, so if I told someone, how could I, you know, if they asked, you know, how could I even answer it, because I don't know what's wrong with me. It's just this strange thing that keeps me up at night. So I think the main thing about it was I had always felt maybe there was something I had done that had caused this. And maybe I had done something to myself to bring it upon myself. And I think that was kind of came from when I would talk to doctors and when I would talk to my GP, and kind of the attitude that I sometimes faced where it was like, oh, have you done this? Have you done that? And I think I kind of just felt it wasn't like it wasn't like an all fuck it moment. It was kind of like, you know what? Like, what am I? What else is there? Like, it was a Friday night. I cancelled on my friends again. I was feeling crap. And I was like, there's no reason not to. So I just started it, and it was kind of like, it sounds strange, but it was like, I felt like nobody's going to read it anyway. I think I felt like my voice did not matter. I had always felt or had this feeling that my voice didn't matter. My journey didn't matter. I wasn't really that important or worthy, or I was pretty insignificant. So I thought, if I just go out and I say this, maybe like two people will respond, you know, maybe, and that'll be that. And then when I started to talk and all these people started to answer, it was kind of like, oh my goodness, like, I'm not alone in this. There's so many other people going out there and going through this. And then I thought it was kind of like the fear was lifted. So I didn't have to be like afraid of just talking about it, because it's not something to be ashamed of. It's just normal. Like, this is just my body. This is my body doing its thing. I don't have to be afraid of it or ashamed of it or hate it anymore. And I think that the more I started sharing, the more liberated I felt, because it was kind of like, yeah, this is my body. Yeah, this is something that I have. And then I thought, you know, this is something that somebody else is probably going through and they don't feel like they can talk about. Like, I know, sorry, it's going to gain too much information, but I talk a lot about my boils. Like,
and it's like, not too much information. It's fine.
I talk a lot about my boils because one of the things I struggle a lot with, it's bile mucus, which is just gross, but I struggle a lot with it, bile mucus and rectal bleeding. And like, it was kind of like, you know what, like, I don't care. Like, I don't, it's not Facebook. I don't have my mum on here. Like, I don't have my mum's best friend or the neighbours. Like, I can just say whatever I want. And it was just like, this is, you know, so if I tweet and I say, I'm sorry, if I'm on Instagram and I'm like, oh yeah, so this is, today was really shit, quite literally, bile mucus, you know, it's kind of nice because I can just say it and just be open. And then I would get messages from people being like, me too, like, I have that as well, is that endo related? And I was like yes, we both have it. So it's just kind of like mostly liberating, but then also when you're dealing with like a chronic illness or a chronic pain, you're so lonely because you're kind of in your little bubble. Like, you know, I live with my husband and we have our dog and I have my friends, but like, it's trying to always find someone who can relate to you, and obviously that your loved ones and your friends can relate to you for as much as they can, but they can't really 100% understand the impact of the pain on your day-to-day life. So being able to have that 24/7 support group where you know, you're able to just check in, and you know, some days you don't have to reply to people, you don't have to post something, you can just see what other people are doing. But for me, it just feels really liberating and validating. And for someone, I guess, who's always thought their voice was insignificant and didn't matter, finding a space yeah. where I'm allowed to have my voice and it actually can help someone is yeah. is just really amazing. It makes me feel yeah. happy.
I know you've talked about your experience of surgery as something quite positive, and the fact that, you know, you've got the relief from the bladder symptoms and you're sleeping and yeah. all this stuff. But then you also have these other symptoms that haven't gone away. And yeah. some that have, I think, gotten progressively worse. Do you feel as if, like, are you still on a mission to try to find someone who can help you? Or is this something you're kind of, like, are you coming to a point of some kind of acceptance, or where are you at?
I think I'm kind of in the middle. Like, so for endometriosis, I had my successful surgery, but afterwards I was in a car accident a week after my surgery, and I developed a rare complication. I don't talk about it very often, but which led to internal bleeding. So I was very unwell. So we think maybe some of my issues now might be relating to that, and just that complication. And after that, I developed fibromyalgia, which is another condition on top, which again, I'm still trying to navigate it at the minute. So after I got my diagnosis, after I had my surgery, you know, a lot of people think with excision surgery, you know, a couple of months, you're fine. That's not the case. Like everyone's different and everyone's experience of it is different. For me, my benefits started to really come after 6 months. So some people, it takes 3 months for you to heal from excision surgery, and some people feel after 3 months that they're, you know, top of the world and it's amazing. For me, myself, it took 6 months when I started to notice, and it was kind of like slowly and gradually that I started to notice these little things like, oh my god, I slept last night, like, you know, like I don't need to pee, like this is amazing, like is this what normal people feel, you know, like is this what it's like? So I think like those little things just started to slowly build up, and then my bowel symptoms did ease, and then they came back, and then we're trying to explore if that is endo related, if that's maybe another condition, if there's maybe related to the fibromyalgia. It's kind of just, you're always trying to play pain detective, which is kind of what my husband calls it. It's like, are you pain detective tonight? Because it's trying to like work out, is this an endo symptom, is this something else that might be causing this? But for, you know, for endo recovery, you know, excision surgery recovery, it's really important to ensure that, you know, you have a recovery plan and in place, and something that I chat with people, you know, across the world about. So usually after their surgery, after 3 months, they then start doing pelvic floor physiotherapy just to really help those muscles and to kind of give them the best outcome relief possible. So pelvic floor physiotherapy is a really, really great tool for long-term care. And then also if they still are experiencing some sort of pain, to go into like, to go to a chronic pain team and see if there's anything they can explore there, or a pelvic pain specialist. So for me, like, it's been a year now, which is so weird. My anniversary was like last week. I have had some, it's been a bit of a roller coaster, and I have had some ups and some downs this year, but I'm definitely finally seeing the benefits from my surgery. Like, I still am struggling with some symptoms. We don't know we don't really know where to go with them. And you know, with the fibro, we don't really know. I think a lot of the issues for me personally is that, unfortunately, in Northern Ireland, waiting lists are, I know it's the same in the south, and waiting lists are just crazy. So to kind of get any clarity or to try to make a plan isn't something that is really doable, because you know, you've got like a 2 year or 3 year waiting list just to see someone. So it's trying to manage your day-to-day life in between those lists and those long waits. So at the minute, really, I'm just trying to enjoy every day, and if I wake up, and try to pace myself and to just make something each day count, even if it's a shit day. You know, I'm still working, and I'm still doing things. I'm still trying to take Ernie out for a walk, my dog. Like, it's just trying to make little things count. I know a lot of people who have endo use diet, and they find that if they follow a certain diet, it really, really helps them. I, with my history of anorexia, I've kind of steered clear from all that diet stuff, just until, you know, I feel like I can be a bit more supported to explore those options. So I think that it's just really, I'm still just on the journey of trying to find out where I am. I think when I did get my diagnosis, it was quite a mixed feeling. Like at the beginning, I was so elated. I was so happy that I had this information and I had my answers. But then it was kind of like a calm down, and it was like, why am I 28? Like, why am I only getting this now?
Yeah.
Like, what happened?
Yeah.
Like, and I think it was kind of like I had a huge sense of loss, because it was like for the past 10 years, a lot of the things that I wanted to achieve and I wanted to work on, it was kind of like I was pushing myself to run on empty.
Mm. What would you say to your 18 or 19 year old self, if you could go back to that person who was there with these symptoms again after recovering from anorexia and not being heard?
It makes me emotional thinking about it. I think I would definitely let them know that it will get better. Like, I think when I was in that state, I was in a lot of denial, and it was like, this pain isn't happening to me. Like, whereas what I would do now, going back to myself, just, I don't even know if I could say anything. I would probably just give her a hug, to be honest.
Yeah.
And just be like, it's okay. Like, this is happening to you.
Mm.
You don't deserve this. Like, this will get better. This will get easier. I think one of the things that I definitely, which I really struggled with after I got my diagnosis, was a lot of the things that I didn't do when I was younger, because I didn't know what was wrong with me, or a lot of things I held off doing, or I dropped out of. Like, so when I was 20, I moved to London because I was like, I want to be an actress. Like, it was always my dream. And then I dropped out of drama school because I just couldn't handle the stress and the pain.
Mm.
And then as well, like, when I wanted to do jobs, I like would struggle, because obviously I would have flare-ups and then I wouldn't be able to go into work, and then I would feel like a failure, and then I would leave the job. Mm. And then as well, after I graduated with my degree, I was doing interning in Bristol, and it was very intense, and I had to leave it in the end and move back to Belfast. And it was kind of like, at the age of 28, I'm not where I thought I would be.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I always had dreamed that my career would have been progressed. My dream was either to be a journalist or an actress or do something like that. And I never got to achieve some of those dreams because I didn't understand what was wrong with my body.
Mm.
So it's like, maybe if I, not saying never, like, there's all, I'm only 29, there's lots of time
in
life now. But it kind of feels like I'm kind of back at the reset button.
Mm.
It's kind of like I'm back at that age, though I'm 10 years older, but it's trying to work out, right, okay, now I actually know what's wrong with me, so
yeah.
I know what I can do, I know what I can't do, I know what my limitations are, I know what to ask for, because, you know, obviously, at that age, I didn't know there was anything wrong, so I didn't let lecturers or university staff know that there was anything wrong,
mm.
So now, you know, if I have a job or an employer, I know to say, listen, I have this condition, this is how it impacts me, this is how you can support me. Whereas before, I knew nothing of that. So I couldn't even say anything to my younger self. All I could do is give her a hug, because the next 10 years are going to be pretty rough. But they have good memories too, and they have a lot of positivity as well, and there will be lots of nice things that happen. Unfortunately, the pain just kind of overshadows things, and
yeah,
a lot of the times I didn't let myself take, so there were times that I did take chances and I did just jump and go for things, and I kind of had to just have it one toe, like a dip in my toe in it, I couldn't just jump in.
Yeah.
So there were times that I tried my hardest, and I feel that now at this age, it's kind of like, not that I'm being reborn, but it's kind of like just starting that stage that I was at, because I know what's wrong and I know where I can go.
Mm.
But I just, it's just, it, you do definitely feel like a sense of loss, and especially from my history, because I, you know, I was so unwell for my teenage years, and there was a lot of loss then.
Yeah.
And then now, you know, my 20s have kind of been overshadowed by this. So
yeah,
I just kind of hope that at least now, you know, I'm 29, so I'm going through and entering my 30s, knowing what my limitations are, knowing what's wrong with my body,
mm.
and feeling a little bit more empowered,
mm.
that there's no secrets anymore.
Mm.
I'm not a stranger in my body. I'm not a stranger in my skin.
Mm.
Like, I know what's wrong. I know what the peonies. It's nothing to be afraid of anymore. It's just me.
That was Sarah Rose McCann on Bits of Me. If you're experiencing similar symptoms to Sarah and want to talk to someone about endometriosis, you can message her on Instagram, where you'll find her as My Pelvic Pain, or contact the Endometriosis Association Ireland. As always, reviews and shares of this podcast are massively appreciated, as I really believe that these stories deserve to be heard. Thanks for listening.